Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 59 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Part 2, a conversation with Aaron Carter, WSU winter wheat breeder. If you're coming to this podcast without having listened to episode 58, the first part of my conversation with Aaron Carter, you'll miss some important details about his life, his WSU breeding program, the value of program technicians, and how he balances work and family, among other things. Any true Northwest Weedy listening now at least recognizes the name of Orville A. Vogel. For those few who might not, Vogel was a kind of godfather-like figure among breeders. Not only was he a mechanical whiz, developing various pieces of equipment in the 50s and 60s that are still in use today, he is also the man responsible for breeding the first semi-dwarf wheat, Gaines, released in 1960. The Washington Grain Commission established the Vogel Chair in 1990. It was held for many years by WSU geneticist Kilvander Gill. In 2016, it was announced the honor, and the research money that goes with the endowment, was to be shared by Carter and WSU's spring wheat breeder Mike Pumphrey. I asked Carter what sharing the Vogel Chair meant to him and his program.
I mean, one, just to be able to kind of have that legacy of Orville Vogel and just kind of holding that distinction is definitely, you know, something that's very humbling for just me personally. But as the program goes, you know, is what it does is it offers a lot of resources through that endowment that aren't necessarily tied to any one single project. And so sometimes as different projects come along or different concerns come along from growers, you know, we can take a little bit of that endowment money and maybe do some preliminary work to see, you know, is this something that's going to be viable? Sometimes we can use that to develop some preliminary data so that we can go to a competitive source like the USDA and get some grant support for that issue. But like I say, it's just kind of this availability of being able to do a little extra, you know, or within the breeding program. If I want to look at a new technology or invest in a new technology, then I have those resources available to go out and invest in that new technology and see if it's going to work in my breeding program or not.
So if a person like John Moffat, who just retired as a breeder from Syngenta, represents the older generation of breeder, then you're the newer generation. How's the newer generation breeder different from his retiring colleague?
I think a lot of it is what resources are available to us. So, you know, a lot of times I'll talk with Bob Allen, and he's been around a lot and has a great source of knowledge. And we'll talk about different projects and, you know, he'll mention, oh, we tried this or we tried that 50 years ago, but it didn't work. And I have to remind him sometimes that, right, but we know, you know, about these DNA markers, or we can now sequence different genes. And so we understand a little more about what's going on, whereas back then, a lot of it was more difficult to understand. And so I think that's kind of this newer generation coming out. We have a lot of different technology at our hands. And I mean, even me, although you call me the newer generation, you know, what I was doing 10 years ago in my PhD, as far as like genotyping and genetics goes, is totally different than what my students are doing even right now. So, you know, technology is moving fast. Of what we can do, being able to sequence different things, and then just, you know, different cameras and sensors and drones and, you know, kind of that technology, and being able to look at processes within the plants like photosynthesis. Yeah, 50 years ago, you couldn't look at a plant and understand how well it was photosynthesizing, and today we can. And so just having that technology, I think, really is what the difference between the two groups is.
There's only so much of you and money to go around. What do you consider the number one value of the WSU wheat breeder position? Is it teaching and training a new generation of wheat breeders, or is it competing with private industry to release varieties?
Oh, the number one value. I mean, that's kind of hard because, you know, when you look at what we do in the university, right, we are teaching and training the next generation of wheat breeders. You know, that's kind of part of our process. So there's definitely that value there. that you don't always see in the private companies. And it's not that all private companies don't do that. They definitely offer internships, and you know, they definitely want to train the next generation as well. But being in the university setting, you know, that's definitely a main focus. So there's definitely value there compared to somebody in the private industry, because that is a focus of me as a breeder, is to, you know, give that knowledge to others. But then at the same time, like I mentioned earlier, competing with private industry to release varieties, again, has that value, because everyone's trying to release better material. And so if there was no competition within releasing varieties, again, someone could put a variety out there, you know, and maybe it's resistant to 4 out of the 5 diseases, and that's good enough. Well, who's going to get that 5th disease in there, right? The person who wants to release the next variety. You know, so if you can walk in and say, well, I've got 5 out of 5 now, right? There's that competition there. So that competition definitely has value as well.
People often talk about the corn model and how universities in the Midwest went from releasing varieties of corn to being the institutions where germplasm development is conducted and private companies release varieties. Some believe that's a model that will come to WSU's wheat breeding program eventually. What do you think?
Yeah, I wish I had a crystal ball and could tell you if that's what's going to happen or not. You know, a lot of it's going to depend on hybrid wheat. You know, a lot of different private companies are looking at hybrid wheat. And that's really what drove the corn model, is once you went to hybrid corn, there was so much of a yield advantage to hybrid corn that definitely growers were drawn to that system. It's a system that a private company can easily maintain, easily capitalize on, and it's profitable for them. And so, you know, I mean, time's going to tell with the wheat system, and, you know, how much genetic gain are we getting from hybrid? What's the cost of production from hybrids? That being said, that doesn't preclude a university from continuing to develop hybrid wheat. You know, so I think it's going to be part a decision on the university itself. If we find out that, yeah, hybrid wheat is something that, you know, really benefits wheat production, there's nothing to say that a university system couldn't switch and start producing hybrids as well, just like a private company does. And I think we've seen that a lot change, because even, you know, within the wheat industry, you know, most companies, and, you know, public or private, we have royalties associated with our varieties. You know, we're kind of already in that system of capturing gain on the varieties that we're developing. And so I wouldn't see it difficult to switch to a hybrid system if that's what we needed to do.
And as you read the science about the hybrid wheat that Syngenta is developing, and I also understand Australia has theoretically had a breakthrough with hybrid wheat, what do you think? Is it going to be in farmers' futures here?
Yeah, again, it's hard to say, because we see a lot of the science side of it, but we don't see a lot of the economics coming out yet. So yeah, as far as hybrid wheat goes, you know, we know there is an advantage. That advantage varies a lot between different reports that we read. You know, what percent increase are we actually seeing? What we don't see a lot of is how much is that costing for them to develop? What kind of technology are they using to develop that hybrid? You know, because that's proprietary within their own organization. So again, are there benefits to hybrid varieties? Research suggests there are. Is that enough that is going to change the entire system to hybrid production instead of more of a pure line cultivar selection? Again, that's hard to know yet until we learn a little more about the economics.
Interesting. So what sort of pedigree are you using for your crosses? Are you trying to build on proven varieties that have track records in the Northwest, like Matson, Eltan, and Rod? Or are you bringing in germplasm that is more far removed?
Yeah, so a lot of what we do builds upon past successes. The Pacific Northwest is fairly unique in that, you know, we do soft white, and our environment is fairly unique. You know, so kind of the upper Northeast, Michigan, New York, from Cornell, you know, they do a little bit in soft white as well, but our germplasm is fairly set. The nice thing is, when you look at a lot of the different companies, we kind of have different backgrounds within our own program. So my program is very different than like Oregon State University's program, although we're both doing soft white. So when I cross with Oregon State University material, it brings in more genetic diversity, even though we're both in the PNW, we're both doing soft white production. So we can still get a lot of benefit from crossing with elite material in the Pacific Northwest.
What about bringing something in from England? What about bringing something in from Argentina?
Yeah. So we definitely do that as well. It takes a little longer still to develop it, to get it to look like a PNW wheat. You know, sometimes it will be too early, too late. It doesn't have the resistance to stripe rust that we need or some other disease. So it takes a little more effort, but we still bring that in because it still is important to bring in new genetics, bring that into the program and keep that diversity going. So you know, if you looked at my program, you know, probably 75% of it is crossing within the diversity of PNW adapted material, and then 25% of it's probably bringing in new germplasm from different areas. And that's really going to depend a lot on what traits we're looking at. You know, so sometimes we're crossing to it just to bring in new diversity. Other times we're looking maybe for a specific gene, a new type of resistance. And so we're crossing that material to specifically bring something in.
What do you think the potential is for the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technique when it comes to wheat research and development?
Yeah, so CRISPR-Cas9, there's definitely some uses for it. You know, part of it is you really have to understand the gene that you're interested in, what that gene does. A lot of times it has to be what we call loss of function. So the resistance comes when the gene is no longer functional. And so, the example I use would be something like the polyphenol oxidase gene, and that's the gene that turns things brown, right? It's in our bananas, it's in our apples, it's in our potatoes, it's in wheat. So that's why when you bite a banana and a couple hours later, it turns brown, right? So that would be something like in a wheat system where when they're making noodles, they don't want them to brown. They want them to keep that nice bright white color. So if we could go in and make that polyphenol oxidase gene non-functional in wheat, then we've solved that problem. And so that's like a technology where CRISPR-Cas9 would be very useful. We could go in, we know the gene, we know the sequence, we can make it non-functional. Unfortunately, in wheat right now, there's very few of those genes that we actually have that level of understanding on that we can really specifically target. There's only a handful of them. So it's going to take a lot more research on the genetic side to make CRISPR-Cas9 really useful in wheat. But we're getting there. I mean, every day we're learning new things about wheat and the genetics. So it'll get there, and it can be a useful technology. You know, again, it's just that balance of market acceptability, usefulness of the trait, marketing of the trait. You know, so it's this complex system.
I think there's a lot of people who don't, well, I think there's a lot of farmers who don't realize that 2016 was the record yield per acre for winter wheat in Washington, 78 bushels an acre. And the reason we don't recognize it is because of all of the falling number problems. We just lost sight of the fact. Do you think that we're anywhere close to the upper yield limit?
I don't know. I think we still definitely have a ways to go with yield potential still, because yield potential is built of so many complex factors, both genetic and environment. I mean, slight changes in cropping systems, planting date, row spacing can increase yield itself. And I don't think we've done enough research in actually identifying what we can do to maximize yield based on just a production system, and then let alone going into different disease resistance genes, and are some genes more costly, if you will, than others? You know, maybe if you have two resistance genes, does one put more cost on a plant to provide that resistance than another? Again, we just don't know a lot about that yet. So I think, again, as we understand the genetics more, as we understand production systems more, I think we can keep moving yield higher and higher. I think we've got a ways to go before we actually reach a plateau.
Do you think the need for quality will always be a drag on yield?
Well, personally, I don't think quality is a drag on yield right now. You know, again, as I mentioned previously, when you're selecting all these different traits, it's these decisions about this kind of give and take. You know, so if I have superior end-use quality and acceptable yield versus superior yield and acceptable quality. You know, which one of those varieties makes it out? But I think it's been shown, you know, as we focus in, if I want to release a high-yielding line and a high-quality line, and I tell myself I'm not going to give on either of those, we can still produce those. So, you know, when you look at some of the recent lines that have come out, you know, a lot of the club wheat has maintained high yield and still excellent end-use quality. On the soft white side, you know, we have varieties like Puma that are high-yielding and good quality, varieties like Bobtail that are high-yielding and quality. So like I say, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. A lot of it, again, is just when you're looking at these 50 parameters to release varieties, sometimes we'll give on one to get high gains in a lot of other categories. So on the quality side of it, again, we want to make sure that everything we're releasing meets market expectations. And, you know, when you look at the rating systems and you look at something that's like that most desirable, those are far exceeding our market expectations. So, you know, even if we release those varieties that fall in that acceptable or desirable categories, those are still good quality wheats that meet our markets. And so, you know, it's that balancing act is what we're really wanting to stay away from, is any varieties that will start decreasing that overall quality of, you know, kind of what the PNW is known for.
But if we didn't care about quality in this region, if you were only breeding for yield, you could breed higher yielding wheat. Isn't that true?
I could select varieties that had higher yield, yes. But it's the same for any parameter. So if you told me you didn't care about disease resistance, I could select, you know, because in any given year, there's varieties that have high yield potential that I remove from the program because they have poor end-use quality, or they're susceptible to a disease, or, you know, whatever other thing is negative about them that I feel is not acceptable. So yeah, if we didn't care about anything, you could definitely just focus on yield and push the yield limit faster. But because we do care about these other things, you know, we're kind of have to move them all along at the same time, which, yeah, it definitely becomes more difficult. Every time you add in another trait that you have to select for, you know, that's another category that you got to make sure falls in that acceptable or better.
It appears the climate is changing. Are you investigating how you might be able to adapt varieties to different precipitation timing and cold or lack of cold?
Yeah, definitely. So we've got a lot of support from USDA grants recently that are starting to investigate this. So in the past, we've looked a lot at drought and heat tolerance and the different physiological processes. You know, we've been working with collaborators like Karen Sanguinet to look at root systems and how the root systems can help us. You know, just recently working with Kim Campbell to look at cold tolerance and kind of spring growth and how plants come out of dormancy. And, you know, because every year is a little different, right? Sometimes the springs warms up quick and sometimes we have cold springs, and just making sure our plants can adapt to that. So I think that's, again, where a lot of the research is starting to go, is starting to understand these more difficult physiological processes that in the past we couldn't really focus in on. And now we can start understanding them. We have technologies, sensors that can help us understand these physiological processes.
What's the roadmap ahead for public research and money coming into public research?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, there's always going to be those competitive sources, whether you're looking at like the USDA or the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, right? They always have those competitive calls that go out. So that's definitely an area where public institutions can go and get money for research, you know. And then, you know, we've had a long standing relationship with the Wheat Commission and just the community in general with our stakeholders, and we receive a lot of support from them that allows us to do the breeding. And so, as I mentioned earlier, that's kind of where we try and couple those two together, where we look at, we've got the breeding program and we have a lot of that base support from the Wheat Commission for that breeding program, and we leverage that to get these competitive funds through the USDA and the National Science Foundation so that we can make our breeding program more efficient. So a lot of the, again, a lot of that funding that comes through those competitive sources, like recently we got a grant on pre-harvest sprout and the falling number issue. So if we didn't have that support for the breeding program, it would have been very difficult to get that support from the competitive money. But because we got that support from the competitive money, we're now making better varieties to release to the growers. And so, you know, the road ahead, I think a lot is kind of making sure we always maintain this research realm that's benefiting the breeding program and maintaining a high level breeding program so that we are competitive for that research money that's available. You know, and then again, looking ahead, it's as far as what are we targeting in as I mentioned previously, I think a lot of the research now is going into those physiological processes, understanding the plant better, understanding the plant soil interaction better. A lot of these things that are just those difficult questions. You know, sometimes I like to say, you know, we've been doing this 100 years, we've answered a lot of the easier questions, and now we're starting to get into the harder questions that need to be answered, like root systems, right? No one looked at them before because they're so hard to look at. But now we're starting to get technologies that allow us to start looking at root systems. And so that's a lot where the research is starting to go.
Well, they do talk about getting to the root of the problem, don't they? That's all the time we have. Thanks for joining me for episode 59 entitled Part 2, A Conversation with Aaron Carter, WSU Winter Wheat Breeder. I hope you've enjoyed the show and will join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
You think we're simple, you think we're not bright. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.